right. Hello, everyone. As usual, those in the Zendo are outnumbered by those on Zoom. I will begin by going around to greet people on Zoom. And then in the Zendo people will say their own name and we can repeat it. And let me just, that'll work. All right, starting with Bob. Betty, out on this lovely day. Jim, Paulette, Marv, Christina, Paola, Pat, Camille, Amelia, Vin, Karen, Yashay Soki, Travis, and somebody with green leaves. I think I've forgotten your name because it's not written there. Sabrina and Tyler. And then in the Zendo, Shoketsu, Linda, Jinryu. Okay. Let's see. In terms of announcements, this week on Tuesday, we begin the class series where we will be reading Kjogen Carlson's book, You Are Still Here, which Bob is holding up. And the reading assignments for that will be are on the website and will also be in the email newsletter, the weekly email newsletter, because we won't read every chapter. Let's see, there is a guest. So yeah, there's a guest speaker on December 12th. Thomas Bruner will be here giving a talk. And then we'll have another week of regularly scheduled programming, and then we'll go on holiday break, basically between Christmas Eve and New Year's Day. So then we'll start on January 2nd with regular stuff.
Is Thomas gonna be on Zoom or here?
Thomas is willing to come in person, so he'll be here like this, I believe, as long as we can get sufficient Zoom tech support for that day. Any questions or things that I have forgotten to mention? Right. So today I'm talking about the 8 worldly wins. So this is one of the foundational Buddhist teachings. And one way to slice the Dharma tomato. So I've said there's, if the Dharma is a tomato, there's many different ways to slice it. There's the Eightfold Path, there's the Four Noble Truths, there's the my 9 fields of Zen practice. This is another way to slice it. And the gist of it is, without practice, we are blown about by what are called the 8 worldly winds. And they are pairs of winds, actually, positive and negative, 4 pairs of winds. So it's gain and loss, status and disgrace, sometimes success and failure. The translation I'm going to read today is, we call status and disgrace. Talk a little bit about that. Praise and blame, or praise and censure, and pleasure and pain. So I'm going to be repeating those quite a number of times. So, and I'm going to share an excerpt, actually most, of a Pali Canon, short Pali Canon Sutta about this. And then we'll explore what it means, what each of those winds are a little more, and what it means to be blown about by them and how do we practice with that? And a little bit about how to receive or hold or use this teaching along with many other teachings. Sometimes I've heard people observe that Buddhism seems kind of negative, like it's always focusing on our faults and our delusions and that kind of thing. How we need to be detached from the world, let go of self. But it comes from this basic premise that, like, we would be healthy and happy and well-adjusted except for these illnesses that essentially we cause for ourselves. So it's a matter of diagnosing and finding those illnesses and curing them so that we can be more free and wise and compassionate and whatever. So it does mean, you know, like, in a sense, if we have any kind of stress or suffering in our life, means, you know, we're not quite healthy, not quite 100% healthy. So we go and explore what is keeping us from being healthy. So in that sense, you can think, I mean, Buddhism is positive because it talks about, you know, you can cure these illnesses. You can be a healthy person. And also, Dharma study is about exposure to the teachings. So if you never read it or you never hear it, you never encounter it, you won't have it available to you. And when you encounter a teaching, it may or may not be helpful to you. You know, it may be just like, whatever, like that wasn't particularly inspiring or helpful. So then you just let it come in one ear and go out the other and not worry about it. But it's possible at some later date, you know, you'll be like, yeah, what was that about the eight worldly winds? You know, and then you know such a teaching exists and then you can go find it. And, or you may find it very helpful and, you know, a way to frame your practice, something you can carry with you for the next week, or maybe it'll really stick with you. So if it intrigues, inspires, or bothers you, I encourage you to engage it. Otherwise, just don't worry about it. So the sutra that I'm going to share today is called the Loka Vipati Sutta. And this is a translation by Tanisiro Bhikkhu. And my podcast mentions this a few times, but there's a website called Access to Insight, which has lots of Pali Canon suttas and writings on it. And they have a great search feature and glossary. So basically I just went there today and I just said eight worldly winds and boom, this sutra comes up. So, you know, if you like that kind of thing, I encourage you to do your own research. In this translation, so I just wanted to make a note on Tanisiro's choice of the terms status and disgrace versus success and failure. And Tanisiro, in my experience, is a translator, so this would have been translation from Pali. And he's a translator who tends to stay truer to the character of the Pali words, even if it means the English is a little less accessible, as opposed to more interpretive translators who are like, what's going to make sense to English speakers? But what I like, he's the status and disgrace. Now, success and failure can seem more objective. Did you succeed in shooting that basket? Did the ball go in or not? So then there's an aspect to that. But our success and failure all take place within a social context. So in a way, there's something conveyed by this status and disgrace. It's like within the human system, within our life, you know, different success and failure within that context is what really gets us. And then praise and censure versus blame. So blame, again, I really, you know, can be more objective. Like, you can't really be to blame for something. Like, you were responsible for it. You caused that thing to happen. As opposed to somebody blames you for it, like possibly publicly, possibly not even fairly. So there's this, again, there's this social aspect of being censured by our fellow human beings. So we'll go more into those a little bit. But he also, in this translation, he calls it the eight worldly conditions, which spin after the world, and the world spins after them. So I had this picture of like the windy wake of a semi truck, you know, like the workings of the world generate these winds, and then the winds generate more movement in the world. And I'm going to read this relatively short sutta and then pause for comments or questions before I go on to the rest of my talk. So if there's anything in here that intrigues or you're like, what does that mean? We'll pause and talk about it. So this is the Lokavapati Sutta. So this is the Buddha speaking. Monks, these eight worldly conditions spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. Which eight? Gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. These are the eight worldly conditions that spin after the world, and the world spins after these eight worldly conditions. For the uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, there arises gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. For a well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, that is a person of practice, there also arises gain, loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. So what difference, what distinction, what distinguishing factor is there between the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones and the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person? So the gist of it is, you know, what's the value of practice? What can we do about the eight worldly winds in terms of practice? So the Buddha says, gain arises for an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person. He does not reflect. Gain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. He does not discern it as it actually is. Similarly, with loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. His mind remains consumed with pain, with gain. His mind remains consumed with loss, with status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, pain. He welcomes the arisen gain and rebels against the arisen loss. He welcomes the arisen status and rebels against the arisen disgrace. He welcomes praise and rebels against censure. Welcomes pleasure and rebels against pain. As he is thus engaged in welcoming and rebelling, he is not released from birth, aging, or death, from sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, or despairs. He is not released, I tell you, from suffering and stress. Now gain arises for a well-instructed disciple of the noble ones. He reflects, she reflects, gain has arisen for me. It is inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. She discerns it as it actually is. Similarly for loss, status, disgrace, censure, praise, pleasure, and pain. Her mind does not remain consumed with gain or with loss or the others. Her mind does not remain consumed with pain. She does not welcome the arisen gain or rebel against the arisen loss. She does not welcome status or rebel against disgrace. She does not welcome praise or rebel against censure. She does not welcome pleasure or rebel against pain. And thus she abandons welcoming and rebelling. She is released from birth, aging, and death, from sorrows, lamentations, pains, distresses, and despairs. She is released, I tell you, from suffering and stress. So that's the entirety of the sutta. A few repetitive lines left out. Any questions or reflections? Betty.
So how about now?
That's good. That's good.
That's okay.
Yeah.
So something that stuck out when you were reading is that that's in so much conflict with like my professional or one's professional life, right? Like you have to seek out accolades and good reviews and all that stuff. You know, you have to really work. I come from academia where it's like a thing. So anyway, that just struck me as a source of conflict. Anyway, that's all.
Yeah, and we'll talk later about like what does it really mean to welcome or rebel against. Yeah. Marv. I can't. Let's see. Let me turn you off a little bit. Try again.
But it's second what Betty said.
What did Betty say? I think.
About academia teaching you the opposite. Anybody hear me?
Yeah, you're kind of muffled, but that's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. My point is, because of that, I've been working with the worldly winds for a long time. And I find that even though you recognize the inconstancy, because even when you get praise, you just want more. It doesn't last. And when you don't get it, you feel miserable. Even when you recognize how much that is causing suffering, the habit you develop is so deep, you still fall into it. It's like that biography in five chapters, the hole you keep falling into, even though you know it's there.
Good point. Paula?
Well, I was wondering if you could address that within the context of human life, of loss of death and grief. Like, how do we have, you know, death of someone we care for, or a climate catastrophe that we've experienced in Vancouver or British Columbia recently and still ongoing, tremendous amount of stress and grief and loss. How would we address people suffering in those situations in the context of the sutra?
That is a great question. I mean, because what I love about this sutta is how it says, you know, okay, if you don't practice, you experience these winds. And if you do practice, you experience these winds. Like practice is not gonna help us avoid these experiences. But like, then it's the question of, well, what are we aiming for with respect to the winds? And I like that image of, like, if you think of it as a wind being buffeted about by it, as opposed to having some kind of, you know, deeper way of functioning, some deeper source of equanimity or peace or guidance in the midst of all of that. So I think I will end up getting to that. So I wanted to reflect a little bit on the winds themselves and how we experience them. So this is one of our myriad lists, right? The original Buddhism especially, you know, five hindrances, eightfold path, and eight worldly winds, and all this. So this is one of our many lists. And remember, this is not about judgment. This is not, you are bad or weak if you find yourself buffeted by these winds. This is just like, this is just an observation about the human condition. This is what our life is. It happens in our lives. So gain and loss, if we deliberately exclude the other winds of status and praise and pleasure for the moment, think about what is it that we can gain? Material possessions, of course, security, health, love, friendship, a happy and stable family life, skills, knowledge. We work hard for many of these things and we gain happiness from them. This is part of what we do as human beings. But we do often, usually, fear. Subtly or acutely at times, we fear their loss. And when we lose them, we experience grief and trauma and stress. And, I mean, it's like, and I think there's something very natural about that. I mean, if beings and things and relationships are part of our life and we lose them, it's like we lost a hand, right? It's like, ouch, I really miss that. You know, it's natural. And we'll talk more about, like, well, what are we trying to do in terms of practice with respect to that? And then status and disgrace, of course, you can think about jobs, careers, advancement, promotion, power, influence, income in that income and wealth in kind of the status sense of things, not so much in terms of the gain and, you know, material comfort and security, but like more in terms of, you know, look at what I can own or do, or even certain relationships as you know, symbols of status. And disgrace may come when we lose our job, or we're demoted, or we become obsolete, and then we have to work a low status, low paying job, and suffer not only perhaps from relative poverty, but also from kind of the shame of relative poverty, as opposed to the status. And if we put our sense of selves into what we have achieved or attained, then we're particularly vulnerable to these winds. And then praise and censure. It's wonderful and important to get positive feedback from people. You know, it's how we know we're on the right track. If you tell me afterwards, you know, I really got something out of that Dharma talk, that's great. If you say, I didn't understand a thing you said, should take that into account. You know, I mean, we're social beings. We live within a culture It's, and if people say we're helpful and smart, admirable, strong, a good friend, ethical, lovable, kind, generous, that's good. A good reputation is valuable. And we live within a culture where what is appropriate is to a large extent socially defined. What it is appropriate and skillful to say. I mean, you just look at over the last 100 years how much that has changed. What is worthy of praise and what is worthy of censure. So it's not a wrong thing to be attuned to this social parameter. But when we find that people change their minds about us, when they censure us or blame us, they're angry at us, whatever, whether we recognize we made a mistake or we don't think we made a mistake and it feels just unjust, it can be extremely, you know, disorienting, painful, disempowering, etc. And then, of course, pleasure and pain. Fairly straightforward, thinking all the sources of pleasure in your life, not just physical pleasure, but health, relationships, food, travel, music, sex, exciting experiences, gardening, reading, learning, you know, service, all the sources we derive joy from in the course of our lives. They give our lives meaning. We anticipate pleasure. We pursue pleasure. Yes. And pain, on the other hand, can be emotional or physical, associated with the loss of pleasure, or associated with a whole new phenomenon like illness or aging or loss, unfortunate circumstances like Paola was talking about. So the 8 worldly winds, I think, do a pretty good job of summing up the realities of human life, positive and negative. So notably, in terms of another teaching about the 6 realms, the human realm, the realm we're in, is characterized as a mixed bag. So it's kind of by definition, our realm is defined by like this disorienting mix of what is so sweet and what is so terrible. That is the challenge that we face. But it's also said, just, you know, to use this as mythological imagery, metaphorical imagery, it's said that the greatest suffering experienced in the 6 realms is not that of the beings in hell, where they are tormented unimaginably, just like in the hell realms of other religions. But in heaven, where heavenly beings, they don't stay there forever. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful realm. It's even a spiritual realm. But they don't stay there forever. And they say that a deva, this heavenly being, sees the end coming, like long ahead of time. They see it coming. And gradually they lose, like it says, like in devas in heaven, they never stink. They don't have to wash. They never stink. But then they start to have an odor, you know. And that this anticipation of the loss of heaven is like the most torturous pain. So that certainly, as human beings with these 8 worldly winds, we can relate to that. That, you know, it's the very love and appreciation and passion that we have that, you know, then we anticipate the loss. So it's significant, as I mentioned, that a person of practice, a well-instructed disciple of the Noble Ones, also experiences the 8 worldly winds. Practice does not prevent loss or pain or disgrace or censure. And I think, you know, those of us who are trying to live an upright, ethical life, be a good person, would be extremely painful to have people angry and upset at us or publicly censure us. So we do our best to prevent, you know, the stuff that's painful. But we're not in control, total control. So what does it mean to be blown about by these winds? So the Buddha says that an uninstructed, run-of-the-mill person, an ordinary being who isn't practicing, isn't living deliberately, hasn't heard the teachings, he says they do not discern whatever it is they're encountering, positive or negative wind. They do not discern this as inconstant, stressful, and subject to change. So this is about recognizing the Four Noble Truths, that everything is impermanent, ultimately ungraspable because it's constantly shifting and changing. And it's not to say that things are never pleasant or peaceful or enjoyable. But if we base our happiness on impermanent things, our lives will be full of dukkha, dis-ease, because even when things are going well, we have that sense that eventually things possibly could take a turn for the worse at any time, or eventually they will change. And then the Buddha says that someone who doesn't practice, their mind remains consumed. Consumed by gain or loss or praise or censure or pleasure or pain. So what does it feel like when our minds are consumed with something? I think we know it. I think we know that feeling, even if we can't necessarily explain it. And frankly, we're usually happy to have our minds consumed with thoughts of gain, satisfaction from gain, well-deserved status, fame, praise, pleasure. You know, it's enjoyable to have your mind full of that. When our minds are consumed with the positive, though, we're unlikely to give much thought or energy to practice. So this is, they say in the beings in the heaven realm are not inclined to practice because, you know, why? Everything's so great. But then they haven't made a foundation of practice when they see that end coming. So this means that we remain unprepared for loss and disgrace and censure and pain, which will come to us at some point in some form. If we've based our equanimity and our happiness and our sense of self and meaning on impermanent conditional things, we are likely to end up quite lost when the winds change. You know, blown off our feet, blown across the room, blown off the road. Without a strong practice, our minds will then be consumed with the negative. We haven't gotten in the habit of not being consumed with the winds. So then we'll be consumed with loss and disgrace and shame of censure, agony of pain. And so finally, the Buddha says the person who does not practice is engaged in welcoming and rebelling. I like these, a lot of times this is called grasping or pushing away, but I like these welcoming and rebelling as terms. Because feelings of attraction and aversion are natural. You know, ouch, I don't want that loss. I don't want that disgrace. I don't want that pain. I don't like it. I do like that. I like this pleasure. Those are those basic feelings. In Buddhism, we say they pretty much just arise. I mean, you can influence their likelihood of arising over time with practice, perhaps, but certainly in the moment, there's nothing you can do about that. You like it or you don't like it, but that's a very basic response, and it's our choice what we do next. So if we feel that sense of attraction and we go, all right, I'm going to get more of that, or some aversion, and then we are trying to push things away, the rebelling. So if we think our happiness, our very sense of self, our life's meaning is dependent on the eight worldly winds, we will be obsessed with their arising and passing, and we'll be struggling with them. But fortunately, there is a better way. And that's what Buddhism is about. So it's not just don't enjoy anything because everything is empty and impermanent. It's more, you think your happiness and peace of mind is dependent on the eight worldly winds, positive and negative. That it's dependent on impermanent, graspable, ungraspable things, but it isn't. A deep, unconditional happiness and peace of mind is accessible as soon as you, as the Buddha described, you discern things as they actually are and abandon welcoming and rebelling. And I think of this as the experience of it isn't what you might think it is, right? From if you just hear it described, to recognize things as impermanent and stressful in the sense that if you try to hold on to them, you're going to create stress for yourself. It can actually lead us to more intimacy and appreciation. You know, if you engage your loved ones with that sense of like, this will not always be so. You're going to approach them in a very different way than if you're just thinking in terms of like, I need this person, they make me happy. And then abandoning welcoming and rebelling. And this is not, I think this is something we have to discover for ourselves. So like has been mentioned before, okay, maybe you're in academia and you have to like seek a good reputation. You have to build a reputation. So how do you do that without going too far in a sense? And I guess it's like we experiment, we know, okay, this is too far. This is starting to cause stress and attachment and suffering. Now I'm kind of just maybe we can opt out too much too. I mean, I suppose you could just solve that whole problem by just quitting academia. But that's not like the Buddhist path isn't quit. Isn't just like, well, just don't do anything. So how do we remain engaged but without? And it's an open-handedness. It's a recognition that this, in a sense, it's a recognition that this is a wind. This is not, you know, so I guess I would say, like, I was once very caught up in the praise and blame, praise and censure. Very, very, very sensitive to that. You know, my own insecurities was like, if somebody that I respected said, oh, good job, you know, it was just like, all right, now I know I'm okay. And if they implied anything other than complete perfection, I was just devastated and crushed. I was like, yeah, I stink. I'm not worth anything. So talk about, you know, buffeted by the winds, right? It depends on like what this person says to me one way or another. And I noticed one of the things my teacher said to me at one point was that I was a black hole for praise, that like somebody could just like throw praise at me and I would just be like, yeah, 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 yeah. Like that doesn't fill the hole inside, right? And I know it's not true, but if you criticize me, I'm like, yeah, you're right on. That is definitely, oh my God, you've got me there. So I had this weird relationship with, and somebody could thank me for something, and I would essentially just brush off their thanks. So over time, after some healing and after some recognition, more recognition about this, the wind of praise and blame and like the futility and sadness of being blown about by it, you know, was able to come to a place where, okay, like you should say, there is some praise. Praise has arisen. Sometimes this arises and sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes it passes. And it can be, oh, that's nice. It's, it feels nice. Maybe it's good information, but it's not like, it doesn't reflect some kind of inherent reality about me. On the other hand, like it's almost, if we're not as attached to the positive wind, if you will, you can actually have more appreciation for it. So if somebody says, you know, I just love your podcast, it does so much for me, I can sincerely be sincerely glad about that and say, thank you. I'm, you know, great, that's encouraging. You know, that makes me want to do more podcast episodes. But I don't think, yeah, I am hot shit. You know, like there's not, I don't draw a conclusion to it. So then if somebody comes along and they say your podcast is crap, you're like, you know, that's interesting that you would think that, you know, what is it about it that you, you know, makes you say that? But it's not a, if my confidence and sense of self and happiness is rooted in a deeper place than the winds, then I'm not as going to be as buffeted about by them. So one, there's lots of different examples we could discuss, but I just came up with one this morning about, let's talk about what this teaching means in relationship. Say you are, the most precious thing in the world to you is family. This is true for many people. So what does it mean for our minds to be consumed and to engage in welcoming and rebelling with respect to this particular situation? So let's say your children and grandchildren are the light of your life, and your relationships with family give your life meaning and are your main source of satisfaction. The most painful thing you can imagine is losing these people or having to watch them suffer. And the primary focus of your life is family. The joys and sorrows of family members are an absorbing drama. And maybe being, if you believe that your happiness, your sense of self, is like completely tied to familial happiness and harmony and the continuation of these relationships. You know, if your mind is quite consumed, you may tend to interfere too much or worry too much because it's extremely painful to watch family members maybe making choices that cause suffering or disharmony to themselves or others. Might be kind of tension that builds up and conflicts and struggles with family members. And maybe for the most part, being consumed with family happiness and well-being and engaging and welcoming and rebelling, it may not be an unmanageable state of affairs as long as things are going relatively well. But what about when certain family members become alienated and cut off relationship? Or when somebody gets angry with you and accuses you of terrible things. Or when you have to watch someone surrender to addiction or an abusive relationship or suffer from a debilitating disease. Now, most of us are more than willing to face this kind of pain and difficulty in service of relationships. And practice isn't about cutting off the relationships or the feelings so we don't experience any kind of loss or pain. So what does practice look like in this situation? Like I said earlier, perhaps recognizing that nothing can be grasped here. The people, the relationships are changing. We can't hold on to them. They are, if we're a little bit more open-handed, these conditions, I can appreciate these conditions, but this will not always be so. So we might be able to be more open-handed with people. For our minds not to be consumed with, either the pleasures or pains of that family life, the longing and difficulty and rehashing of conflicts or whatever, to be able to have some freedom of mind to practice, to get some perspective, we can actually be better in relationship. And abandon welcoming and rebelling. This can be about how we act in relationship, but it can also just be about what's in our own mind and heart. Definitely rebelling against, the way certain people act. that there's an aversion that arises. Okay, might prefer for somebody not to act that way, but the rebelling is I should be able to find some way to make this stop, to push it away. Or, the welcoming, can translate into some level of neediness, affirmation and contact. So that was just my brainstorm about that. I will leave it there and invite people to make comments or questions about the eight worldly winds and what does it mean to practice and not be so buffeted about by them without withdrawing. Because really when we withdraw, essentially so we don't feel pain, that's just self-centered as well. That's just about us wanting to protect ourselves. So we got to stay engaged, and yet how do we stay engaged without being buffeted about? So. Yeshe, you're still muted.
This is so spot on for what I've been working on the past few days, with very focused intention. And I try to give a brief example from work where I'm being asked by the head person to be responsible for certain students. And I ask specifically what the goals are. I have the goals. And then another teacher interrupts and says, while I'm with two of the students, oh, I want you to go do this with this student, which is not in line alignment with the goal for that student. And it also means I'm abandoning the two other students and there's nobody with them. Or another example would be, it's like passing the baton to me and is annoyed with me, but I won't, because I haven't taken off running, but I can't take off running because she hasn't let go of the baton yet. So I'm kind of stuck in an impasse. Or talking over with me when there is a student there, which is, it can't say anything else because it's overwhelming for the student, and frankly, it's overwhelming for me. And so you named all the feelings I was having of annoyance, anger, sadness, because I want to show up and do my best, and yet I'm experiencing simultaneously so much confusion and conflict about okay, I'm a substitute. So do I do what this person is wanting me to do, or do I stay in alignment with what my original assignment is? And yet I have to do what she's saying. So I'm constantly having, I'm in this place of tornado wind of the winds are definitely there, and trying to balance out how to move forward. And also there is an aspiration, because I do enjoy working there, that I would be invited back, and wondering is, does she have enough influence? Like she said to someone, oh yeah, it was fine, but she's not you. Well, I'm not you because I'm me. So does that mean I wouldn't be invited back? And then I asked the question of myself of, is there something in how I'm presenting myself that is, because this is my life that's being played back to me. So it's a reflection of me at the same time that I'm living this. So all of this is going on, and I'm aware of how I could even trace it back to patterns back in infancy, and also keeping the focus on, well, as you were saying, well, who am I really here? What is my real essence here? So I'm not getting buffeted around. And yet at the same time, I still have this conflict and confusion, because I still have to show up and act. And so I'm abandoning my duties that I was tasked with, because this person now wants me to do that, or is upset with me because I'm not doing that. So I don't know how to resolve the conflict, except for two things. Is one, don't let it wheedle itself down into my self-core that there's something innately wrong with me. And if it comes out that I not ask back, oh well, I have to just figure out another possibility. But I'm definitely feeling blown about, and at the same time aware that, huh, that's interesting how there was another time and I would have just totally recognized that these things are arising in me, but without being blown about, I would just would have been watching it. Mm-hmm. So it is a reflection back that I would say in this past year, my practice has been more shaky, and yeah, I guess I'll just leave it at there. So yeah, it's, but again, don't tip over just because it's been a little more shaky. Just keep the awareness and don't go into the wanting to avoid the place, well, it should be this way or should be that way. No, it shouldn't be. It is what it is, and that's what it is. So it shouldn't be any other way than what it is. And I am who I am. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity is take it as a gift for me. It's like, huh, look what's coming up inside me with all these winds blowing around. It's not really comfortable at all, but that's what it is. Thank you. Yeah.
I like the imagery of the wind because, you know, it makes it clear that it's not an either or thing, right? Are you bothered or not bothered? It's like, well, it depends on how badly the wind is blowing, you know? It really, like, I got in a very minor car accident on Friday night, and, you know, guy ran a red light, hit me, nobody was hurt, whatever, but like, you know, as I get out of the car and we're sitting there in the middle of the intersection getting each other's, you know, insurance information or whatever, and that, I mean, I was aware that, like, you know, I'm just kind of wandering around in shock, right? I'm kind of just like, what am I supposed to do next? Who am I supposed to call? I don't know. But there was a kind of awareness that, like, yeah, that's what happens. You know, in this kind of circumstance, you kind of lose it. You know, you're not like super with it. And, but just the awareness of like, oh, a wind is blowing. A wind is blowing, and it's not like, And I as best I can, try to keep my center. And I'll get my center back. And the wind will stop blowing so much. And to recognize, like, when you have to go into a situation like you're talking about where, okay, you know, there's a storm brewing in here, and I'm still making the choice for one reason or another to go in here, but I'm prepared for the winds. I don't know. Helps me think of it as more of a engaged, dynamic dance with what happens. Jinryu.
I don't know a lot, so I don't know where are we about time.
A few minutes.
My question is, or my comment is brief, and one of the things you said, you said a lot of things that really got me thinking, but this whole scenario about the family, and what happens if somebody gets really mad at you, and what happens if you're dealing with a very serious illness in your family or addiction in your family or all of the awful things that can happen. And your question was, what does practice look like then? And my first thought was, it looks the same as it's always been, but that only works if you have a practice. But if you do, I do, and I would have, my practice looks like that. The only other thing I can think of is, depending on how hard that wind is blowing, I might intensify my practice more, meditate more, practice mindfulness more, read a book on meditation and or mindfulness related to whatever problem I have. That's what was on my mind.
Thank you. And I think there's something core here, which in original Buddhism they don't talk so much about, but in Mahayana and Zen, it's like we don't just see that these things are not, they're not self, right? The praise does not reflect some kind of ultimate reality about you, neither does the blame. That you are not something that can be pointed to or grasped. So there's no one here to take the credit or the blame or whatever. It's a changing set of conditions. So we talk about that kind of, in a way, it's kind of a negative thing, right? Identifying what's not self. But there's also this, you know, learning to be grounded in our true self nature, which is no self nature. Our true self nature is just like, this moment, I am meeting this moment as best I can. And whatever happens, if I get knocked over by that wind, if I get fired, if I end up under a bridge, if I end up, you know, with a fatal illness, if I end up fired from the Zen Center and vilified from all Zen communities in the country for some reason, I mean, that is like, that. There I will be. Like, there's, if you're not trying to hold on to what is impermanent, it's actually okay. Like, well, it's not okay. It'll still hurt. It'll still, like, you don't get to escape pain and all that. But if there's something deeper, it's not as terrifying. It's not as disorienting, not as threatening. All right, I will end there with our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Everybody. Thanks, Damio. See you next week.